Taxes, trade deficits, and peanut butter. Just another Friday in this economy, gang. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, the 17th of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The president is back from a big trade trip. As you know, the House and Senate are grinding away on taxes. We are here to review and discuss. Catherine Rempel is at the Washington Post. Lynette Lopez is at Business Insider. They are both in our studios. Where are you guys? In New York, right? In New York. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
All right. So I'm going to play you both a piece of tape. It's Kevin Hassett, the chair of the Council of Economic Advisors at the White House, did a little back and forth with reporters today. I'm going to play a piece of tape. I want to discuss. Here he is. Here it goes.
So trickle-down economics is something that, you know, I guess people who criticize the idea that taxes affect the economy will use to characterize approaches like the one that we're pursuing.
So, Catherine, trickle-down economics, of course, the idea that you cut taxes on the wealthy and on businesses, that trickles down through the economy. It is basically what this tax plan is built on, the GOP tax plan. Does it sound to you like Kevin Hassett is banking on voters not understanding how trickle-down economics are supposed to work?
I think that voters are pretty jaded about the entire concept of trickle-down economics, which, you know, for decades has alternatively been known as voodoo economics,
yes,
coined by a Republican.
Almost sounded like he didn't really believe it either.
Well, yeah. There was a lot of that,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think his argument was essentially this is bad branding, whereas if you look at the economic consequences of previous major tax cuts, it's not just about branding. It's about what are the actual consequences. You know, did this trickle down? Mm-hmm. Did giving money away to the wealthy, to the quote-unquote job creators, to corporations, did it actually translate into higher wages for the middle class? And the evidence we have so far is that no. I mean, maybe some of it helps, but by and large, the benefits go to the wealthy.
Well, so Lynette, the other thing Kevin Hassett was asked, and I should have grabbed this tape and I didn't, he was asked by Major Garrett from CBS, I think is where Major is right now. He was asked whether we could go back in 5 years, if Trump's still in the White House and we go back and look at this, will you stand by this prediction that this is all going to have trickle down? And Hassett did not answer that question. So how are we going to know, when are we going to know what the effects of this thing might be and how will it be measured?
Well, that's why trickle-down economics have been so elusive. You know, people who support it point to the fact that we can't prove that it doesn't mm-hmm. work. But what we do know is kind of what we've been hearing over the past week or so. The Senate plan raises taxes on everybody making $75,000 and below by 2027. That's what taxpayers understand. That's what voters hear. They hear that corporations get tax cuts forever and we get a temporary tax relief.
Right. Catherine, let me ask you this. Is there a sense, because, I mean, you've been writing about this a lot, do you have a sense of what the final product might look more like? The Senate bill, which includes just, for instance, the repeal of the individual mandate and some of the stuff Lynette was talking about, or the House bill? Because they're going to have to come to some agreement.
The problem with the Senate bill is exactly what Lynette pointed out, which is that the individual side provisions, by and large, expire. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what they had to do to get the math to work out. They made the corporate provisions, for the most part, permanent, the individual provisions temporary. So one essentially funds the other. And the politics of that are awful. Right. I mean, the message to voters mm-hmm. is lower and middle income households are having to subsidize or basically pay for the tax cuts for everyone else. So in that sense, it's hard to imagine a final product of whatever this process produces looking like the Senate bill. But, you know, basically, we don't know what's going to happen once this thing gets to conference, if it gets to conference, meaning that, you know, the Senate will pass something. It'll pass whatever it has to do because of those marginal votes that it needs to get, since they have to get 51 votes, and there are already at least two that are questionable at this point. They're going to have to do what they have to do, but then, you know, all bets are off, basically,
exactly,
once they hash it out together.
Lynette, let me back you up to the whole trickle-down economics thing. We had a guy on the program yesterday, Ed Fryer. He's an economist who's also a chicken farmer. And he said, you know, I run a pass-through business, and my rate is going to go from 39.5% to 25% under this bill. And he employs 1,700 people, and he said, that's going to let me grow. There's a difference in this economy between those kinds of businesses, which will get the pass-through, and the really big ones, which also conceivably could also get the pass-through, right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, what everybody's really worried about, too, when it comes to pass-throughs, and one senator has already said that he's not going to vote for the bill because of this inconsistency with pass-throughs, is that, you know, you're not really fairly judging businesses by what they actually contribute or what they do. You know, the pass-through rule makes it almost sound like these are small businesses, but some of them are quite large.
Like the Trump Organization.
And make a lot of money. Right. So not all pass-throughs are created equal, even though when people talk about it, they talk about it as kind of a small business regulation type thing.
Lynette Lopez is at Business Insider. Catherine Rempel at the Washington Post. There is so much more to talk about on this thing, you two. Maybe next week. We'll see. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Guy.
All right. Bye-bye. On Wall Street today, now that a tax bill is within reach, traders honestly don't seem to know what to do with it. Down just a bit across the board. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, we're going to do a little macroeconomic policy. 2 + 2 = 5 here for a minute. Taxes and trade are the subjects. The president, as he was on his way home from that big Asia trip this week, said he wants to get America's trade deficits, that is, the difference between how much we import and how much of our own stuff we sell overseas. The president wants to get those deficits down and quickly. He also, though, wants tax cuts paid for by increasing the federal debt. And that, thanks to, you know, economics, is where he's going to run into trouble. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains the connection between trade gaps and budget deficits.
Under both the House and Senate tax plans, points out Mary Lovely, professor of economics at Syracuse University, the deficit's gonna rise.
Somewhere in the order of $1.5 trillion.
Meaning the government will spend more than it earns, even more than it does already.
Someone has to fund that.
The money's got to come from somewhere. And so the U.S. government will sell bonds to get it.
It's very unlikely that American citizens would buy up all those bonds.
We aren't the best at saving up money to put into bonds. We're more of a consumer-type nation. But the government needs someone to buy these bonds, so it may sweeten the deal.
By raising interest rates.
Now, who do you think these new bonds and higher interest rates are going to attract?
Foreign residents say, oh, there's some new government bonds. That seems like a good idea. Interest rates, fine. Let's buy some.
Foreign investors. And while they're at it, they'll pick up some other U.S. investments. Those look attractive, too, now that the government's raised interest rates in the economy. So to buy all this American debt and assets, foreign investors are going to start switching out their yen and their euros and their yuan and their reals and their dinars and their rupees for dollars.
And that will push up the exchange value of the dollar.
The dollar gets stronger. And what does that do to American exports? It makes them less competitive, hurts manufacturers.
Our exports will become more expensive for foreign residents. Meanwhile, imports in the United States will become cheaper.
In other words,
we'll have a larger trade deficit.
This is the exact thing that President Trump wants to avoid. Here's Trump just last Wednesday.
We have almost an $800 billion a year trade deficit with other nations. Unacceptable. We are going to start whittling that down and as fast as possible.
But history has shown that expanding the deficit makes that very difficult.
I like to think back to the early 80s as probably the prime period when we had a great example of this happening.
Bob Murphy was an economic advisor to Bill Clinton and is now a professor at Boston College.
Real interest rates went up sharply. The dollar started its strong appreciation. And under Reagan, the trade deficit, you know, worsened to the largest share of GDP that we'd seen historically.
All of this is to say the president may have to choose which he wants more, a tax cut financed by deficit spending or narrowing the trade deficit. Going to be real hard to do both. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
In Washington today, at a fortuitously timed meeting of African foreign ministers, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson called for democratic elections in Zimbabwe and a rapid return to civilian rule. The coup that's not officially a coup could be, and maybe it is, the end of Robert Mugabe's 37 years in power. Equally unclear, though, is how Zimbabwe's very broken economy might be fixed. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson went looking for the answer to that.
Bear with me for a sec, but Zimbabwe actually has a lot going for it. John Campbell is a fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations.
The country is intrinsically rich, good agricultural land, minerals, a relatively educated workforce. It's English speaking.
Problem is, President Mugabe's economic policies have resulted in inflation that's currently about 325% a year and unemployment that's above 90%. So to start, the country's going to need to undo much of what he's done.
The government is going to have to reestablish some kind of fiscal discipline to stop the runaway inflation.
Jennifer Cook is director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Maybe next would be to create the kind of investment-friendly environment that's going to bring big investors in.
For example, allowing foreign investors to acquire a majority stake in businesses and rebuilding the decimated agricultural sector.
This is not rocket science.
Steve Henke, a professor of applied economics at Johns Hopkins University, says common sense changes could have a big impact in Zimbabwe.
From 2009 until 2013, they used the U.S. dollar exclusively, and they had a coalition government, and the growth rate was 11% per year. That's hotter than China.
And potentially very interesting to American investors, eventually. That's if Zimbabwe actually does the hard work of making these changes. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Like the man says, you like peanuts, you like Skippy.
Chunky, smooth, or hydrogenated? First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 100 points today, 0.4%, 23,358. Chunky, by the way, is how you take your peanut butter. Come on. The NASDAQ off 10 points, about a 10%, 67.82. The S&P 500 shaved off 6 points, 0.2%, 25.78. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow off 0.2%, the NASDAQ up 0.4%. S&P 500 down about a tenth or so. Construction of new homes climbed 13% in October, with builders breaking ground on both apartments and single-family houses. Home builder D.R. Horton raised the roof 0.2%. Cal Atlantic Homes locked up 1.3%. Clothing in a box company Stitch Fix strutted onto the Wall Street fashion runway with its debut on the NASDAQ. Big gains early on. Shares in Stitch Fix sewed up 1% by the end of the day. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. This has not been the greatest of seasons for the National Football League to date. There have been politics, about which we've all heard. There have been declining television audiences, and now some boardroom drama in a $14 billion a year enterprise. Jerry Jones, the owner of the Dallas Cowboys, is in a back and forth with his fellow owners over whether to renew Commissioner Roger Goodell's contract. Andrew Beaton wrote about it today in the Wall Street Journal. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
How did this beef begin with Jones and Roger Goodell? Because they used to be buddies.
They used to be, I guess, the best of buddies in terms of the owner-commissioner relationship. But I think the one way to really look back on this that people have pointed out to me is that it really begins and has ended with the Ezekiel Elliott suspension. People said as soon as 2 days before Ezekiel Elliott was suspended in August that Jerry Jones was still very much in support of Roger Goodell's contract extension, which he clearly was back in May when he was one of the 32 owners who unanimously voted to extend the commissioner. And that once Ezekiel Elliott was suspended in August, that's when Jerry Jones really started to change his tune.
And now they are swapping letters in which Jerry Jones says Roger Goodell's actions are inconsistent with the league's performance. And the league is saying, owners are saying, Jerry Jones's antics are detrimental to the league. This cannot be good for, as Roger Goodell likes to say, the shield, right? Brand NFL.
And I think that's one of the problems is that how this is played out, not necessarily publicly, but usually the owners really like to present a unified front.
Yeah.
But it becomes a problem when he is publicly attacking the league and publicly threatening a lawsuit against the league and the fellow owners. And that's where they've really started to take issue, that this has become a nasty fight instead of a disagreement over an important issue.
Is it fair to call Jerry Jones the most powerful owner in football?
I think there's a time when I don't think many people would have disputed that. I think it's a line that would draw eyes from some of the other owners. There are longer tenured owners in the league, but he's also made some incredible business decisions for the league in the past. You go back to the early 90s, he was behind some of the big television deals that really turned the NFL into the marketing and media behemoth that it is today. It's not as if that power is all very old. It's that it's increasingly becoming in a vacuum and wondering if he's just alone on this issue and there's no amount of weight he can swing to change the conversation.
If the other owners, Bob Kraft and all the rest of them, who you know, none of them are shrinking violets, right? If they get sick and tired of Jerry Jones, what can they do about it? What can they do? Can they force him to sell the team?
It's an idea that has been mentioned. Whether that not that's realistic, that is a totally different conversation. But here's the thing. They see what he's doing with threatening lawsuits. They see a potential that he was behind the critical comments from Papa John's of the NFL, they're a big league sponsor. And if you want to talk about what could constitute conduct detrimental to the league, those seem like the type of things that they could point to and try to prove to say this was conduct detrimental to the league.
So how does this end? How does this shake out? What's your guess?
Oh, boy. If I had that type of crystal ball, I'd be doing something else. But I think there is a way for all sides to save face here in terms of whether this extension ultimately includes a lot of incentives. But we'll see. There's meetings coming up later in November and then in December when this could either become even tenser or it could get resolved.
Andrew Beaton writes for the Wall Street Journal today about the NFL. Andrew, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Trump administration has a bunch of economic priorities. Healthcare was the first, also tax cuts, as we started with today, also federal regulations, specifically cutting them. Regulations have a huge, although largely hidden, effect on this economy. And how regulations work, how they come to be, and what they do is the focus of this season of our documentary podcast series, The Uncertain Hour. Oftentimes, you can learn the most from a single, seemingly simple example. Marketplace's Chrissy Clark brings us the history behind the regulation of peanut butter.
In the 1950s, the peanut butter industry was dominated by two brands that are still household names.
Like the man says, you like peanuts, you like Skippy.
Skippy and
Peter Pan peanut butter is so great. Smoothest peanut butter in the land.
Peter Pan. And in fact, smoothness was the secret to both these brands' success. Food chemists had figured out that if you pumped hydrogen molecules into some of the peanut oil in peanut butter, turned it into hydrogenated oil, you could keep it from separating out of the peanut butter and make the product way more smooth and spreadable than the old-fashioned kind. But in 1958, a new brand with a little colorful kangaroo mascot hopped into town.
There's a great big peanut paste in Jif.
What changes things is then along comes Jif.
Angie Boyce is a researcher in bioethics at Johns Hopkins University. And she says, sure, new peanut butter brands were showing up all the time back then. But Jif's entry onto the scene was different for a couple reasons. It was at the time made by Procter & Gamble, one of the biggest companies around. And there was this rumor that started going through the peanut butter industry about Jif. No one's quite sure where the rumor came from. Maybe a company spy? Industrial espionage around peanut butter was actually really common in the 50s. Or maybe the rumor was just gleaned from rival companies carefully inspecting Jif's peanut butter.
You know, peanut butter manufacturers have a lot of expertise in their product. So maybe through being able to taste the peanut butter and its sensory qualities, what in the industry they would call its organoleptic qualities, they might have been suspicious.
What word was that? Organoleptic?
Organoleptic.
But somehow, through organoleptics or spying, there was this whispering going around that, wait a minute, Jif's peanut butter feels a little too smooth, a little too spreadable. Like, what's in this peanut butter anyway? And just as important, what's not in this peanut butter? Which is when something comes across the desk of an enforcement official at the Food and Drug Administration.
This was just a very brief memo
Angie is one of the few people still alive who's actually seen this memo. She showed it to me when we went to the National Archives together to look through the FDA's peanut butter files. The memo starts,
"In accordance with our conversation, I am referring this peanut butter file to you. We have had at least two complaints from other manufacturers of peanut butter about the addition of foreign ingredients to peanut butter."
Complaints about foreign ingredients in one brand in particular.
Jif, put out by Procter & Gamble.
But what sorts of foreign ingredients? The FDA did a little detective work itself.
FDA had gone in and an inspector had been doing some inspections.
That's FDA historian Suzanne Junod. She says inspectors went snooping around the Procter & Gamble peanut butter factory in Lexington, Kentucky for 3 days. And when those inspectors reported back, they had some intriguing news. According to Jif's own factory formula, like the kind that might be typed up and hanging on the factory wall, at the time, Jif peanut butter was only made of
75% peanuts.
Only 75% peanuts, but also, for texture, up to 20% something else.
Crisco.
Crisco base.
Crisco. You know, the white stuff that people use to grease pie pans. So yeah, smooth and spreadable. But as Angie Boyce of Johns Hopkins points out,
one would assume that customers would not find Crisco in their peanut butter as acceptable.
Or maybe they'd be okay with it. FDA officials started asking themselves, is a jar of brown paste that's made of only 75% peanuts really peanut butter? If not, how many peanuts should peanut butter have? And what about that 20% Crisco? Crisco was, after all, just a form of hydrogenated oil, not peanut oil like the other peanut butter brands used, but a mixture of cheaper oils from rapeseeds and cottonseeds and soybeans. Would consumers care? Here's the FDA's Suzanne Junod again.
The question, of course, is where's the dividing line between frank adulteration with cheaper ingredients and a legitimate product for which the consumer has shown support?
Because that's part of the FDA's job, as required by law, by Congress, to create regulations that promote honesty and fair dealing in the interest of consumers. So in this situation, what is fair? That answer was clear for at least one consumer, a housewife turned activist named Ruth Desmond, who had recently co-founded the Federation of Homemakers. When Ruth heard about how many chemical additives, how much non-peanut stuff was going into many peanut butter brands at the time, Jif and Skippy and Peter Pan, she was shocked. Ruth died several years ago, but her daughter, Janet Swager, remembers coming home from high school one day and her mom telling her,
"Can you imagine that these scoundrels are trying to pass cold cream off as peanut butter?"
Cold cream, that old-fashioned white goopy makeup remover. Janet says that became Ruth's nickname for all the hydrogenated oils.
She said, "That's terrible. They want to make money, industry, by putting less and less peanuts in the peanut butter. And like she said, it's children that are eating these peanut butter sandwiches mostly. And here they're trying to put cold cream in there and use less peanuts."
Ruth thought peanut butter should be at least 95% peanuts. And she started a letter writing campaign. Almost 2,000 people from all over the country sent comments into the FDA. Those letters are also now stored in the FDA's peanut butter files.
"I understand there is some controversy over how many peanuts should be in peanut butter. Let's have plenty of peanuts and peanut butter."
Some are typed, some handwritten. One person sent in a telegram
that just says, 100% peanut butter, please, please, please. "It's an important food for children. We would like the protection of the regulatory agency in our interests."
And as these letters poured into the FDA, it was clear that the battle over what makes peanut butter, was on.
You want to hear how that battle turned out, right? I know you do. Subscribe to the podcast that Chrissy hosts. It is called The Uncertain Hour. This final note on the way out today, which comes, and this is a true story, It comes as I had to explain to my mother this morning. She's visiting from out of town. She asked, while we were shopping for Thanksgiving stuff, why the Core Consumer Price Index that takes out food and energy prices is a better measure of inflation than the headline number. It's a true story. She totally asked. Because, as she said, what? Economists don't buy food and gas? Anyway, told you that so I could tell you this. The American Farm Bureau says the cost of a traditional Thanksgiving meal, turkey and all the trimmings for a gathering of 10, is down 1.5% from last year to a national average of $49.12. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 100 today, 0.4%. The NASDAQ off 10 points, about 0.1%. The S&P 500 down 0.6%. I'm in serious trouble, by the way, if my mother is listening today. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have a great weekend, all right? This is APM.